have a roll call, please.
Governor Pat Quinn, Secretary Schneider, Chair Wolf.
Here.
Director Bates. Director Darcy.
Here.
Director Gonzalez.
Here.
Director Peterson.
Here.
Director Reddick.
Here.
Director Sweeney.
Here.
Director Towne.
Here.
Director Weissman.
Here.
Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everybody who came to the special meeting, which was, I guess, our first 2013 meeting, and thank you for coming to our regular meeting today. I have not been notified that there's anyone who is interested in making public comment. Is there anybody who would like to make public comment? No. Okay. So I will call for a motion for the approval of the minutes of the regular board meeting and the executive session for December 15, 2012, please.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, thank you. I'd like to turn to committee reports. For those who are unfamiliar with our system here, we have a series of committees that operate on weeks that the board doesn't meet, and the chairs of the committee will report on the activities of those committees, which will then feed into our regular consent agenda. These issues are vetted at the committee level. So why don't we start with Finance Administration Operation, Chair Peterson.
The Finance Committee met on January 16th. Finance presented two items to the committee, including two renewals of claims administration services of Cannon Cochran Management and renewal of the Employee Life Insurance Program of Minnesota Life. Each was selected through an RFP process back in 2009. Therefore, they're in the final year of this optional renewal, and RFPs will be issued to these services for the coming year. Fees for Cochran are the same as the expiring contract, as well as the premium supported by Minnesota Life will be reduced by about 15%. Procurement had five items which were approved by the committee. We amended an award to Miles Chevrolet for the purchase of police vehicles. After the December meeting, it was determined that CMS, through the master contract, had to amend the contract to allow the vendor an economic adjustment due to some upgrades in the vehicles that were
standard equipment, yes. 2013.
So that was approved in that meeting. We also had an order against the CMS master contract for Mythics, Oracle Software Licensing Support Maintenance. Also a contract to Anderson Lock Company for safe repair and maintenance services. A contract renewal to tollway request to Cullen and Associates for Legislative Liaison Services for, I think it's in, during the last year, I believe, of that service. And the emergency procurement for Cumex for lubricants, greases, and oils. That was an emergency purchase that we had to make at that time.
That's correct, because the CMS master contract had expired
at that time. Engineering had presented 19 items to the committee. Of these, 12 were placed on today's consent agenda. Engineering is recommending two items be removed from the agenda. Therefore, Paul's going to speak at some point about the five additional items that are added that we were not able to discuss at the committee last week. Three construction, eight professional contracts were presented. There were seven prime contractors, 32 subs. Who are certified as disadvantaged minority and women-owned business enterprises. Of the $100 million roughly in awarded contracts, about $30 million, 30%, is committed to those firms. In addition, engineering presented a contract for renewal for traffic engineering services through 2014. There were two requests for partial release of retainage and one for final release of retainage that were both approved in committee. And then three items addressing land acquisition to give you the approval to go ahead to acquire land. James Adams, I think, Elgin O'Hare, I believe. Also, their chief engineer, Paul, did provide an overview of improvements planned for the nine maintenance facilities under the Move Illinois program. Construction is scheduled to start this year and will continue through 2026. We are going to unbundle those contracts to make sure we have smaller vendors able to provide services there, and also LEED certified buildings as we go forward. I think Paul's going to touch on that later in this presentation a little bit. Legal presented one item. It was a third extension of the intergovernmental agreement with the University of Illinois that conducts research benefiting the tollway in areas of pavement materials, lane safety, signage, effectiveness, and environmental aspects, and we renewed that for another year. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's turn to strategic planning recap. Director Weissman.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to just take a minute to recap 2012 a little bit, talk about what we accomplished, and then move on to our work plan for 2013. We did adopt a new policy for traffic noise and abatement. We initiated new levels of outreach for our diversity programs. We adopted a new policy for interchange and roadway cost sharing. We also have discussed at some length environmental and sustainability policy, and we'll pursue that more in the coming year. Multimodal planning, there was a presentation by PACE on the I-90 transit planning. We'll incorporate that as we talk more about multimodal planning as well. We adopted a new sign policy, as you know, and we're discussing currently the landscape permit policy. So for 2013-14 here, we're looking at the following items to work on as our agenda for the committee. Customer surveys from the I-90 study, I-90 multimodal planning, continuation of that effort and some finalization, hopefully, and freight accommodation planning. And other cost sharing issues that we haven't covered, this year. Off-peak pricing incentives and tolling review. And again, as I mentioned, we're going to try to bring greater focus on environmental and sustainability planning for both maintenance facilities going forward and as well as the Illinois projects that we had. The strategic planning committee moved the traffic generator and sign policy to the board for approval on the 13th of December. We are working right now on landscape policies, and the effort there is to be consistent, to be, you know, be flexible, but be consistent, and really try to be more orderly in terms of making sure that requests for changes or special projects go through the local government entity, so that there's no confusion and that we all come out of it feeling good about what we end up with. And so that policy is already, that is on the website, and that is open to public comment through February 1. We're getting input from local governments themselves as well, and hopefully we'll be able to solidify that and bring that to the board before very long. So that concludes my report.
Done a lot in the last year and still got a lot on your plate. Are there any directors who wake up at 2 in the morning with other concerns about strategic planning that they would like to add to Director Wisner's list?
You can call me.
Okay. Good. Thank you. It's good to feel as if those things are being addressed in advance and they don't just hit us as we come head on into them. Thank you. And then customer service recap, Director Reddick?
The customer service committee met last week on the 17th. We conducted a review of our work plan and engaged in kind of a more detailed look at our fine and enforcement policy structure. We've talked a little bit about the directive of the direction of the committee to take kind of a customer-based approach to the enforcement policy, and we've given staff some directive to take a look at it. One of the things that we were in position to do at this month's meeting was take a financial look at our enforcement and collection policy. And one of the things that, interestingly, we found is that our leakage percentage increased with the increase in tolls that went up. Our collection versus the amount of the overall tolls missed, we've got a bigger disparity, and in 2012, had a total of $55.6 million in unpaid tolls. After what we recovered and our costs, we were able to gain about $28.5. So that was some new information to the committee and kind of had us rethink some of the information or kind of the position that we had going forward and the direction we had given to staff. One of the things that we talked about and are recommending is a restructure of our notice timelines, and we're going to get a little bit more detail about that when Shauna Whitehead gets here. She's stuck in traffic, but not on a tollway right now. The other things that we talked about and gave direction to is gave staff some information to take a look at reviewing the policy guidelines for the settlement guidelines on toll disputes and prepping of a fleet policy with a little more directive. The last thing that we went over is we did put out, as we talked about at the last meeting, the RFP for the back room computer system. We got 5 responses. They were going through and reviewing that, and we're hoping that by March we may be able to come to the board to move forward with that, which is going to be a big part of a lot of the policy changes that we want to do. And I'm not going to throw it on her right now. Unless you want to.
Yeah, Joe.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Are you sure? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Like Superman, right? Other than.
I know, it's amazing.
The phone booth.
The uniform.
Just in the nick of time.
Yes. It was perfect.
Shall I go up front?
Yeah, sure.
From the table, up to.
So cute. I think the thing is at your place.
The clicker.
The clicker.
I'll take it from here.
Okay.
Can Shauna be seen on camera? I can never tell if people are sitting at the table.
Why don't we go ahead and go up, and then okay. The microphone, I think, is up here, and that'll help too.
Okay.
For people who are watching, the large volume of people.
I know.
Nielsen rating.
Our large virtual audience.
The Nielsen rating.
Cohort,
right, exactly.
All right. And even with the clicker even works this time, it's perfect. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The Customer Service Committee did indeed work pretty hard on this analysis for a long time to determine what the potential improvements could be. And we were really trying to balance 2 goals the whole time. These are not easy goals to balance. The first is protect current and anticipated revenue. We have a major capital program, and we have all these plans and things already rolling. You can't afford to see a major decrease or drop off in revenue, but at the same time, and everybody feels this way, I know they do because I have so many conversations with so many of you all the time about this, we really want to enhance customer service, especially for these well-meaning drivers who violate without intent. They don't mean to. We all get these letters, I know we do, because they often end up on my desk, and we feel terrible for these people and wish that we could help them. So the analysis revealed an option for extending payment time frames, which actually I'm pretty excited about. This goes back to the discussion that we had many months ago at the Customer Service Committee, where we benchmarked Illinois Tollway against some of our major peers in the United States. So when we consider our peers, we consider our open road tolling systems with a decent volume of traffic. I know we're the biggest by far, but these are organizations that have business models similar to ours. And you can see that our days to pay for each level of notice are way shorter than everybody else's. And this might be part of what we hear about when customers come to us. Well, I didn't open in time. I didn't get it in time. I just didn't see it. And we thought, well, looking back at what we, and this is on our website, looking back at where our notice time frames are, 21 days, 14 days, and then 21 days again, we thought, what if we made it a little more intuitive and a little more in line with what the rest of the industry, or at least our peers, do, and just said 30 days across the board for each of these levels. Easier to remember. It probably involves another paycheck cycle for a lot of people. And certainly, I don't know about you all, but I have to admit, I do not open my mail every day. I should. But I don't. I open it every few days as it grows in the stack. And I don't think I'm alone. So we were thinking that if we were able to do this, and there are a couple things we'll talk through in the next slide, it would enhance customer service. It would extend the payment timeline by a full month overall. And it would bring us in line, like I said, with other toll agencies. It would be consistent. It would be much easier to remember. And it's much easier to communicate to customers. There's also a chance it will decrease revenue leakage because people might have longer to pay and they might have another pay cycle to deal with before additional fines are added. Our next steps are, because nothing is ever as easy as saying, okay, 30 days, let's start tomorrow. I wish it were. We do probably have to change our JCAR rules. Those are administrative rules. We have these time frames, or at least some of them, actually, written out in those rules. It shouldn't be too hard to change, but we need to work with our legal team to go through the official process. And then we'll need to deal with the system and change some of the language in the notices, which we've long wanted to do anyway, And then when all of that is done, actually communicate this out to the customers. Say that everybody is going to have longer from this point forward. So that's kind of what we discussed in the Customer Service Committee. And it was very exciting, at least to me, because I have long dealt with customers who keep coming to us saying, I just didn't have enough time. So I think this should be an exciting move for all of us. Any questions?
Chair Reddick, do you want to comment at all on this?
Well, I think that at least the consensus coming out of the committee was that this approach, I think it provides us with a little bit of the flexibility that we've been looking for, we've been talking about, and attempting to achieve. It doesn't have the negative financial impact that, you know, our analysis clearly showed that some of these other changes were going to have. And I think it's a very good first step. We're going to continue to monitor our leakage numbers and as they relate to the the current tollway structure or toll structure, pardon me. And we'll continue to monitor that. But I think at this point, you know, this is something that the committee feels comfortable with moving forward. And I think it does provide us with some of that improved customer service and flexibility that we are looking for without the negative financial impact of the tollway.
And I really commend the committee and the staff for the work. We didn't go through the appendices on this, but there's some really thoughtful quantitative analysis of what, how much money we've brought in historically and what the impact of the change in the toll level is and then what it is likely that we will see if we change these. So you got the headlines, but there was a lot of really thoughtful and rigorous work that went into it. So I want to thank everybody for that. This is not something that comes to the board for a vote. We get a sense of the board and make sure that no one has any issues or problems with it so that we can ask the staff to move forward. For those who are unfamiliar with JCART's Joint Commission on Administrative Rules, it's members of the General Assembly, so it's our legal staff and also our interface with the General Assembly will work on the explaining to the members of the General Assembly why we think this is important. So is there any, are there any concerns by any board members or any questions or comments? I know for the people that I run into who have had violation notices, it will be a relief to be able to say, well, we've worked on this policy. We think it's more rational now because we know you only made a mistake. You weren't intentionally trying to deprive us of our revenue. So and I think a lot of people will be relieved by that. Any concerns? No? Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Director. Thank you for going forward. I don't have anything else under my area, so Christy.
Okay, great. Well, I have a couple of things, actually. I'd like to first ask you to join me in welcoming Colleen McShane to the Illinois Tollway. Colleen started earlier this week as Senior Manager Program Development in the Executive Office. She brings with her a variety of experience in government and the nonprofit sectors, and we think that those will be very helpful in really spearheading some of our, you know, strategic initiatives, some of these big things that we have to do going forward. So we're happy to have her as part of the team. I'd also like to recognize someone, and it's truly my pleasure to let you know that one of our troopers with District 15 was honored earlier this month on January 16th by the Elmhurst Memorial Hospital for saving a motorist's life last fall. Trooper Jason Bradley, please stand up. Please, thank you. As you may know, District 15 is the special Illinois State Police District that patrols the Illinois Tollway system. In early October, Trooper Bradley responded to a call of a motorist having a heart attack alongside the roadway on the Tri-State Tollway near St. Charles Road. It was late morning, so traffic was heavy and no crossovers were open due to the construction that was happening. And rather than traveling several miles along the system to turn around, Trooper Bradley actually parked his squad car on the opposite side of the road and crossed multiple lanes of traffic on foot to reach the motorist. And Elmhurst Memorial Hospital actually did say that they thought that that quick response helped save this individual's life. So when an automated external defibrillator didn't work, Trooper Bradley administered CPR for more than 20 minutes until paramedics could arrive. So really heroic efforts, and we know that there are many of them, but we wanted to make sure to recognize this particular trooper who, I think there's a motorist on our system who can probably give some credit to you for saving their life. So thank you very much. Great work. So I know we'll take a photo with you during the break if you're still around, but I don't want to keep you from going back and potentially another life.
You can stay here
and
watch all of us, make sure we're okay.
Good. So thank you. Also in my agenda, we have one presentation that we've been talking about now for several months. I'd like to introduce John Donato, who you all know, who's the head of our procurement department. Procurement delays have been an ongoing challenge for the agency, and while we worked hard to overcome them and have worked hard to overcome them in 2012, construction was reduced by as much as $84 million due to procurement delays, resulting in the loss of about 1,500 direct jobs and more than $5 million of potential additional costs when we do ultimately move forward with that work. Of course, we're always going to look for ways to reduce that, but you know, the potential and the risk is there. So that number simply reflects, you know, delays in our construction procurement, but also there are ramifications to procurement delays for the goods and services that we have to procure, being the major operation that we are. So today John is going to, you know, walk through again some information that you've probably seen before about the procurement process, and just reminding and refreshing all of our memories about the process. Also talking a little bit about some of the steps that we've taken, some of the things and issues that have come up that we wanted to alert you to, and then some new ideas that we have that we wanted to get your feedback on that we think can potentially help you know, save some time and resources and create some efficiencies in the procurement process. So if we decide to move forward on some of these, particularly something called vendor managed inventory for certain goods and services and job order contracting, those two initiatives we think will save us a great deal of time, and the TOI would be the first agency in the state to implement these innovative procurement programs. So again, we wanted to tee that up. I've just stolen John's entire presentation, as I always do in all of my introductions, but I know John will be adding some details, so he's done a lot of work on this. Thank you. And
sure. Thank you, Christine.
The floor is yours.
Thank you, Christine. Good morning, directors and everyone. So as Christy pointed out, we've had some procurement challenges, as everyone has known, and my top priority for this year is to create additional efficiencies in the process to minimize some of these delays that we have been experiencing. So as a brief overview, as Christy indicated, I will be going through some of the challenges that we've had, talk about some expired contracts that we've had throughout our agency, shed some light on that, talk about some of the ideas that we implemented during 2012, and also propose some solutions for 2013 on the things that we're excited about, you know, the vendor managed inventory and the job order contracting. And also, in with the proposed solutions, that would include both internal and external solutions for us. So this next slide is a chart that I know everyone has seen before in this room, at least the members at the table. And I just want to briefly remind everyone of the entities that are involved in the procurement process. You know, once Senate Bill 51, also known as the Procurement Reform Bill, became effective and implemented. So, as you can see, the two boxes that I highlighted, the first one on the left, that entity did not exist prior to Senate Bill 51 being implemented. So what does all that mean? Well, there's probably three titles that you hear, you know, a lot about in the last couple of years that you didn't hear prior to that. One is the Chief Procurement Officer, the CPO. That's the individual with the ultimate procurement authority in our state that all of our state agencies, you know, report to, that are under the jurisdiction of the governor. Along that is our SPO, State Purchasing Officer. That's an individual, again, who's employed by the Executive Ethics Commission, but it's housed in our building here. And a Procurement Compliance Monitor, which provides oversight to the process and making sure that we're filing all the procurement code, the rules, and all the policies that are set forth by the CPO. And again, this step or this entity didn't exist prior to Senate Bill 51, and you know, in the next couple of slides I'll explain what their role has been. Now the one on the right, the Procurement Policy Board, they have existed for a long period of time. But with Senate Bill 51, they now have an expanded role in the procurement activities, mainly our potential conflict of interest review forms and that whole process. I know that has been a struggle on several of our procurements
bring him to board in a timely fashion. And I think that was brought up at our special board meeting on the underwriter procurement. And I'll dive into that a little bit further on as well. So building off of that chart, I thought it's important that you see this, and this is something that I believe you've seen before as well. This is our general process flow for our solicitation. Well, what does that mean? This is our general flow for the invitation for bids and request for proposals that we engage in. And I specifically highlighted the diamonds here to represent that first box from the last slide, the Executive Ethics Commission, more specifically our SPO and how many times that individual touches our procurement in just in the solicitation phase. This is not including any ancillary processes outside of the solicitation. So there's
so
four
critical. Outside of, so there's a solicitation process, and then when you say ancillary, that means once the selection is made, then there's a whole other process of approvals of
right,
you know,
there's
disclosures or anything else to actually get the contract to the point of being able to be executed.
Correct. That, and there's other paperwork that we're responsible for completing, our small business set-aside waivers, and other approvals as well.
John, does this apply to both the tollway specific as well as the CMS contracts, or is this just the tollway specific?
This does apply to both. Now, for the CMS-led ones, there's always an SPO that's involved, but it's CMS's SPO that's involved, not ours.
The process is the same.
Yes. And there's other, you can't probably tell, but there's a few other boxes here that are highlighted where there's other entities involved in the process. Some of them are the Executive Ethics Commission, others CMS, Governor's Office of Management and Budget, and again, the Procurement Policy Board, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. But again, I just wanted to point out, you know, we're not complaining about the procurement reform that's taken place. We just wanted to point out that these are additional steps that we do have to go through now on. So what are some of the challenges? Again, what Senate Bill 51 really did, it transferred the procurement authority from Central Management Services under the governor's jurisdiction into the Executive Ethics Commission, the EEC. And just to point out some numbers for everybody, and I get probably familiar with this, the typical IFB or invitation for bid, this is where we're looking at the lowest bidder. We know what we want. We're looking at their lowest price per unit.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're focusing on goods and services now. So
the
bidder we do also on the contract side, but this is for all of our goods and services types of procurement.
Correct. So prior to Senate Bill 51, a typical invitation for bid, you know, we routinely could complete that process within 3 to 4 months. You know, post-Senate Bill 51, 6 to 7 months. So we're seeing an additional delay, or it's taking us 3 months longer to complete that process. And similar to the typical IFB, our typical request for proposal, prior to Senate Bill 51, about 6 months, now we're looking at 9 to 10 months. Again, 3 to 3.5 months being added to that process.
Can you give us some concrete examples of what would fall in an IFB and what would fall in an RFP?
Lubricants, sure.
And nuts and bolts.
Yeah, lubricants would be a typical IFB. We know exactly what we want. Give us your price per drum, per barrel, whatever the unit of measure is. Rock salt, that's a typical IFB. We're looking for the lowest bidder on a per ton basis. And our typical RFP is something that requires more of a technical evaluation. Director Reddick had mentioned the back office procurement. That's a typical RFP process where we're looking at the technical responses of the vendors. You know, it's more than just price that's going to drive that, right? Okay?
Thank you. Yep.
Sure. So, and now the favorite part that, you know, I think all of us have come to learn is the potential conflict of interest review process. And obviously it's not our favorite part, but prior to Senate Bill 51, we were completing that process in less than 7 days. There was a review in the agency, a review at CMS, and then a brief review at the governor's office. And we typically see that process completed in 7 days. Post-Senate Bill 51, although we say up to 84 days, because there has been a couple circumstances that went that far, we're seeing it taken generally a little bit less than 2 months, from the cradle to the grave, because there's four entities, five reviews during that process. And again, that organizational chart, the Executive Ethics Commission is now reviewing the potential conflicts to individuals, and then the Procurement Policy Board also has a review in that process as well.
And can you describe what they would be looking for in the conflict of interest, or what is it that has to be disclosed?
Sure. So when firms have certain owners or people who cross certain thresholds at an ownership level, they may identify a potential conflict. Say that they have a spouse that's on a board in another state agency or jurisdiction. The procurement code requires them to list it as a potential conflict of interest.
So we review it, make sure that the vendor complied to the requirements of the statute. We pass that along to our state purchasing officer internally here. Once that review is completed, it goes to CMS Legal Counsel. Once they complete, it goes to the Chief Procurement Officer in Springfield, and the Procurement Policy Board makes the final determination whether to allow the award or to void it based on the conflict, and then it goes right back around that same process. So, you know, in a good example, I think that we talked about at our special board meeting is the underwriter process and how long some of these conflicts take, and this is true in the engineering world too. A lot of the consultants' proposals that identified potential conflicts, you know, routinely take a month and a half to 2 months to go through that process.
So the spouse one would be an example of a more or less simple kind of conflict. If you're an underwriting firm, you have to disclose what that would be more complicated.
There may be some litigation, some sort of debarment litigation. Anytime there's litigation, I think the CPO's legal office does scrutinize a little bit more to better understand the litigation. Is this something that we, you know, because of this litigation, do we want to contract with this firm? Do we not want to contract with this firm? Those are the things that they're really looking at.
Okay, so those are questions of judgment, not questions of facts as much. So that's one reason that it's more complicated.
Correct, yes. Okay.
It can also be the number. So depending on the structure of a company and, you know, the level of compensation, there can be many more disclosures for certain types of companies that are required. So it can be that as well.
Yeah, for example, if a firm is publicly traded, the entity that we may be contracting with may not be the publicly traded firm, but their parent may be. And at that point, they just supply their 10-K, and that, you know, meets the requirement. It, like Christy said, it's the firms with the more complicated structures that maybe have 300 individuals that they have to disclose on, and it's painful for them. So
it's a partnership or something like that.
Yes. So that's some of our biggest challenges. And I see, and you need to see the numbers based on the 3 months increase in both of these procurement approaches, you know, it's directly related to this right here. It has a huge impact. So what does all this mean? What has this led us to? This has led us to 63 expired contracts at the tollway. But, you know, just to put this in a little bit more perspective, we have approximately 350 contracts on the goods and services side. None of these expired contracts refer to highway construction or engineering activity. 350 contracts per year and 1,900 transactions per year. So these 1,900 transactions are the contracts. They're the orders against our own contracts. They're the orders against the master contracts. And these also include one-time purchases. We need a part that may cost $100. Well, we still have to go through a procurement to get that part. So, you know, there's a ton of volume that moves through our department every day. And it adds time. So these 63 expired contracts, I just want to focus on that for a minute or two. You know, our goal in all this is no interruption in business. You know, we're in the roadway transportation business, and, you know, safety is the number one concern. So what are we doing to maintain that safety throughout our system, you know, with these expired contracts? What we've been doing is we've been entering into some small purchases, and small purchases defined as procurements that are less than $35,000. Emergency procurements, we've talked about it several times, that emergency procurements are defined as procurements that are greater than $35,000. And I presented to the FAO committee last week a lubricants emergency. The CMS master contract expired. You know, we're being promised that it's going to get done right away. It's not. We got to properly maintain our fleet. Otherwise, it's going to lead to additional costs down the road. So therefore, we enter an emergency for lubricants and greases to better maintain our fleet. And to put this in perspective, again, let me show you some numbers. Prior to Senate Bill 51 being implemented, we had two contracts that were emergency procurements during state fiscal year 11. Post Senate Bill 51, 18 contracts in state fiscal year 12. And I'm a little concerned because, you know, right now, we're probably on par for that number this year, if not even more. So we're going through a lot of these challenges right now, and that's why we're really trying to build efficiencies into our process as much as we can to minimize that number.
Now, the 63, though, is an improvement. I mean, John's unit has made a concerted effort. Some of those, as he mentioned, it's not just tollway contracts, but they also are CMS masters that are impacting other state agencies or other agencies, public agencies in the state. So that is, I think, the number when we started last year was in the 80s.
Yes,
correct?
That's correct.
So, you know, it's definitely something that between us and CMS we're making an impact, but we recognize that you know, given the, you know, staffing levels that, that we need to maintain and given the process that we are living within, we need to do some things differently if we're expecting to really make any real impact here.
So how much of the improvement do you think is because we've actually taken time off the process, and how much of it is that we figured out it's going to take so much longer that we start stuff much earlier? Or is that hard to quantify?
It's kind of hard to quantify. It really is. I think that now it's clear everyone, all the user departments know if they have a contract that's going to expire, you know, at December 31st, they got to start that process early in the year, January, February. Otherwise, you know, we could increase our number of expired contracts.
Right.
So I think we're on top of that now. It's been clear based on what we're dealing with today. So this next slide is to talk about some of the changes that were implemented during 2012 to minimize that. So again, to fend off some of those challenges, the board, you know, approved a resolution last spring allowing us to list the CMS lead procurements that are under $250,000 on our informational item list. In the past, we presented all those transactions in the boardroom setting here, but with that approval of that, did free up a lot of buyer time to work on other procurements and preparation for board meetings. So that has been working well. We created, well, before I get into this next bullet point, once the EEC had a role, they were following the CMS process along with us. And I think it was towards the end of 2011 is when they went through it on their own system. So then for each procurement we have, we're entering that request in two separate systems. It was a redundant effort, and that was an additional delay for us. So what did we do to manage all that, to manage our portfolio procurements? We had to create a SharePoint-based contract tracking system. That was the one place that we do look at to see where is a procurement at any given time, who's it with, and how long has it been there. So that has been successful. You know, we had some bumps in the road when we first started implementing it, but we're still ironing out all the wrinkles. But that has helped, because again, we're managing our contracts more effectively.
So that would, an example of that would be, before you add SharePoint, something would be stuck in the system, but you wouldn't necessarily know
where or when.
So now you look at it and you say, well, now we know where it is. Let's call that person and ask them what the problem is.
Exactly. What's the delay? What can we help you out with? Can we give you any information? What can we provide you?
We're also tracking, you know, sometimes you find out that they had sent a request for information that, you know, that somebody didn't get, or that there was a need for something. So it has helped with kind of accountability. Putting your finger on where things are.
Right, so that definitely has helped. So at least we don't have to go in two systems to check one procurement, just go in one system now. So and then lastly, something that we have been talking about for several months now that we have implemented last year is increasing the duration of our contracts, both initial and renewal terms. You know, it makes no sense to have a one-year renewal on a process that may take 6 months or longer to complete. You're never going to get ahead that way. And just to be clear on all those contracts, we have termination for convenience clauses in them in the event that we want to pursue other options. So that does provide us some flexibility. So those changes were good, and we definitely appreciated those changes, but definitely wasn't the home run that we were looking for. I mean, we made a little progress. You know, we did reduce the number of expired contracts, but we need something that's going to have more impact, or a huge game changer, if you will. So what are those solutions? The two concepts, additional concepts that I want to present or propose to you today, there's one that's more of a good or commodity-based procurement, and the other one which is more of a service-based procurement. The first one is vendor-managed inventory. Again, this is the goods or commodity-based procurement. And what is vendor-managed inventory, or VMI? It's a streamlined approach to inventory management and order fulfillment, and this is pretty much designed or structured, you know, to stock parts for all four of our fleet, for our light, medium, heavy-duty trucks, pursuit vehicles, off-road equipment. Think of this concept as having a vendor, our own storefront with a vendor in it, supplying those parts when we need it, only the tollway and no other entity. Okay? So we wouldn't own any of the inventory that's in the warehouse, but say we need some brake pads, we put the request for the brake pads, and then once that request is there, the vendor fulfills it, hands the part over the counter. Okay, so let me just go on and talk a little bit more. So as far as the positive impact or benefits of vendor managed inventory, there's a lot, there's plenty of them.